Welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show, where we explore spiritual ideas and books that help you live a better life. Hosted by spiritual teacher and author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate, Jason Napolitano.
Welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show. It's Sunday. I am your host, Jason Napolitano, and I have Chris Sheridan on the line as well. How are you doing, Chris?
Doing great. It's awesome to be here.
Awesome. Thank you for being here. I'm excited about this show today. And we are here every Sunday with a new episode. We look into spiritual books and spiritual ideas. We are both teachers in this area. Chris has a book called The Spirit in the Sky, which is available on Amazon. So check that out. I have a book called If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate. That's available on Amazon as well. Or on my website, cosmiceye.org. And Chris's book is available on his website as well, which is Chris Sheridan. com. Today, I'm pretty excited, Mr. Manly Hall's The Secret Teachings of All Ages, otherwise known as Being an Interpretation of the Secret Teachings Concealed Within the Mysteries of the Ages, The Secret Teachings of All Ages, or An Encyclopedic Outline of Masonic, Hermetic, Kabbalistic, and Rosicrucian Symbolical Philosophy.
The end.
God bless him.
I've read shorter books.
Thanks for joining us. We're looking forward to jumping into this. We're doing what I think will be most likely a three-part series, at least to start. We'd like to go through and do many more chapters of this book because it's such a worthwhile book to study. And if you're a Manly Hall fan or an occult fan into esoteric things of any type, he really covers everything in this book, and it's just a fantastic starting point for discussions, and it opens up so many different great ideas. So we're going to start actually with part one. Now, part one will fool you a little bit because there is a part one, Roman numeral part one, which is actually the introduction we are not doing. The introduction is an overview of philosophy spanning how many years? 3,000 years or something?
3,000 or as long as far back as we have record.
Right, in about 30 or 40 pages. And it's an excellent overview of Western philosophy up to modern times. And I highly recommend it. And you do as well, do you not?
I do. And it's a really concise overview because there's hundreds of philosophers in a really short amount of time. And it's mainly just a one-liner. Well, so-and-so believed that fire was the primary element. Someone else believed it was wind, and going all through more modern contemporary, at least in the early part of the 20th century philosophers.
Yeah,
I think the point is to get this survey of what's been out there in the Western philosophic tradition. And I think what he's laying out is a groundwork for the rest of the book and maybe making a distinction. I think maybe actually making a distinction between, what is philosophy with a capital P and what is so-and-so's philosophy? Well, that's something Kierkegaard or Nietzsche Descartes would say.
Sure.
Cartesian, we can put a label on things. Whereas even though there were people who believed certain things in the ancient Greeks and the area around there, that the philosophy it's an entryway of looking at ourselves and the world that we inhabit.
Yeah.
Really kind of free of a particular brand. You could say the same thing about religion. It's, a universal, connection with a supreme deity.
Sure.
Or even science and inquiry into the physical world. But you start breaking it down and labeling it, it's kind of when you get these problems. So I think he's laying out a case for maybe the playing field from which we're going to look at symbolic philosophy.
That's a great way to put it. And I think also it's a nice section to read to sort of contextualize historically kind of where things are on a timeline. But it's not really anything that specifically we necessarily need to drill down into. It's a pretty good overview. And I think that he does a great job at explaining the things. And so there's really not that, there's a lot to go into, but I am not an expert on ancient philosophy or modern philosophy. So I won't really add much. He is an expert. So we let him do the talking. But what we both are pretty good in is the esoteric stuff. And so that's what we're going to tackle first, was actually section 2. It's Roman numeral 2. It goes, there's three parts of it. We're going to look at part 1 of Roman numeral 2 section, called the Ancient Mysteries and Secret Societies which have influenced modern Masonic symbolism. So we will get into a little of the modern symbolism and the influences that the ancients as we go along, but mostly we're just going to kind of break this thing down and look at what's in here and get into some of the fun stuff that's in and then kind of set up what the mysteries were, what secret societies were and are. We're going to look at a little bit of an intro to the Druids. We're going to look at the literal versus symbolic, and then we're going to go into Christianity and the cult of Mithras and how that influenced Christianity and the Roman world. So that should be pretty fun, and not necessarily in that order, because I think I actually will go through literal versus symbolic before I enter the Druids. So without any further ado, let's jump right into this. So secret societies, mystery schools, what are they? Do you have a quick answer for that? I have some neat stuff that I wrote
sure.
down.
Sure. Well, essentially, yeah. There were two types of learning. There was two types of worship, and there were two types of symbols in the ancient world. And a lot of people knew that they had dual meanings and that there were two learning pathways. One was for the masses, and it's out front, it's in the public square, and you can see the statue of Athena or any other deity, and you can bring the offering and have your public worship. And, you know, just like today, we have preachers and theologians that, you know, give you the message of the day, and it's kind of fed to you. Then there's the other side of it, and that's the secret side that has the ancient knowledge being kept. And it's not so much that's being kept from the masses. It's just that the masses aren't geared, they're not really qualified to do it. So they would find it frustrating and probably boring and really wouldn't help them. They're much better off for the public part of it. And then this secret side was to hold some of the more complex ideas and principles that would be lost on your everyday citizen. But only somebody who has had the time and the training and the dedication, and in many cases proven their oath of loyalty and secrecy to be able to be
sure.
Handed off these mysteries. So in some way, it's keeping it from the public, but in the other way, it's also keeping it alive. And sometimes to keep something alive, you kind of
sure.
have to keep it sequestered and protected. Then it will live, and it won't be subject to some of the everyday adjustments or amendments that, you know, you can just even tell Christianity, it's shaped and
yep.
shifted even in the last 100 years. So this secret thing keeps it hopefully pure to its original source, and it keeps it available for those who know what it is and know how to use it and pass it along. And it does find its way into the public sphere, although it comes
yep.
through ways in which the general public maybe isn't aware of.
Aware. Yeah, that's a great way to put it. The other as you were speaking about, and we'll get into this a bit more, but the exoteric versus the esoteric side of things. So the exoteric, or the outer sort of understanding, what might be that what would be thought of as a literal interpretation of something, a sort of surface view of it. Whereas an esoteric interpretation or esoteric would be the inner or the secret or the hidden knowledge. And so most of those schools were set up with esoteric as well as exoteric orders, so that one had to start in the exoteric outer order, the so-called outer order, and then work one's way into the inner order through a series of initiations. One of the things that's interesting about it is most of them were today, were in the ancient times and are today, three levels, three grades, three degrees. Usually there's some sort of a neophyte, and then sort of a middle ground, and then a sort of a master. In Freemasonry, it's fellow craft and master mason. For example, in The Golden Dawn, a magical one based on Kabbalah, there's three levels. There's a, that consist of neophyte, where you're a basic level, sort of probationer, and inner order, and then an inner order, which has more steps, but essentially it's broken into three sort of stages. And one of the things I was thinking about as I was reading this is why the number three? You know, why these three steps? And you know, there's a lot of symbolism obviously with three, but one of the things that I know, and a very basic interpretation of it is in Masonry, is that it equals the three stages equal the stages in a man's life. So you have basically youth, sort of middle age, and then, or excuse me, adulthood, I guess they'd call it, and then age or wisdom. That would represent, you know, Master Mason would be the old age, wisdom phase. Fellow craft would be the adult, and then the entered apprentices is like a youth. So it represents sort of a maturation process. A lot of them also base it on a sort of idea of birth, life, and then death and rebirth as kind of its own level, things like that. So those are some of the threes that I've ran across. There's a ton more. Does that resonate with you at all? Is there anything you've come across in your studies about three or the levels, the importance of three in those grades?
Well, it's so present in so many traditions. Three, and there's the Trinity. There's the Hindu the Trinity with you know, the Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. There's a completion. There's body, mind, and spirit. Might relate to the novice. You know, the kind of adulthood for the mind, yeah. And maybe spirit, where you're more wisdom, and you're not so concerned with some of the body excursions or the, you know, lifelong learning of the mind, where maybe at the third stage. So they build on each other, but they also complete a whole together. And there's nothing more stable than a three-legged table. That's why we have tripods, not quadrupods. Because if one leg is shortened, well, the other two just compensate. You know, if you set it at a dinner table or something, you have to put a matchbook or a packet of sugar underneath one of the legs because it wobbles.
Yeah.
So there is this inherent stability in it. And so it's...
That's a great way to look at it. Yeah, I like that.
And the three parts are really stages that make a whole complete. But each one is appropriate for the stage. What's great for the apprentice might not be good for the, you know, for the master. It's all good for everybody, yeah. but this is when you have this is when you have that, and at this stage you...
Well, speaking of that, you know, exactly, and speaking of that, we've talked about that quite a bit today, especially with the internet and with the availability of books on places like sacredtext.org and so forth, and how pretty much you can find any of the quote-unquote secrets out there today that any of these mystery schools, except the ancient ones, because a lot of those were not written down and there is no record of them, because those initiates actually had the integrity not to tell the secrets. And we unfortunately don't seem to have that integrity. But the point is that, you know, you can find most of these, including Freemasonry secrets, online. But what, you know, I've heard a lot of Freemasons and a lot of people in these initiatory groups say is that, you know, these mysteries and this quote unquote secret information that you can find online or that you can read in a book is not the true secret information. You have to go past that to really understand the truth. And so that's the beauty of these groups is that, yes, there's quote unquote secrets to them. But I mean, the real secret is how you take that information, apply it to your own life and learn that wisdom and those lessons from the information that you get. And then you discover on your own what those secrets are. That's the true nature of secret information. And then oftentimes people talk about inner spirit guides, or, you know, they talk about teachers on the inner plane that, you know, once you've reached a certain level of meditation or of discipline and so on, that, you know, certain teachers might reach out psychically to you. I can neither confirm nor deny this. However, there are many people who are of this belief. So you know, that's an interesting thing about that sort of secret nature is that, you know, it contains something that goes beyond what we would consider a secret. That just being some information that someone's hiding.
Well,
so
sure.
I think that's
the secret. Sometimes the ability to recognize it has everything to do with who we are as individuals, you know, what training we have. You know, very kind of present example is in Disney movies. It actually serves as an example of this esoteric and exoteric or knowledge that's for the masses and maybe knowledge that's a little more for the, you know, higher educated, because in a Disney movie or Pixar or some of these, you know, kid movies, they're jumping around and bopping each other in the head or doing things that kids are just think it's hilarious. And you know, as an adult or parent, you're sitting there watching, okay, great. Then they throw in these little one-liners, these little zingers that only an adult would get, some obscure reference or something, goes right over the kid's head. They're not even concerned about it. It's just some grown-up talking. But then the adults start laughing because they coded this, you know, because they know parents take their kids to movies. But
sure, sure.
So in the same movie, yeah, you know, two different groups that are completely different educated. You have a, you know, 9-year-old or a 6-year-old, and you have a 35-year-old or somebody. They're both getting something out of it. They're getting different things out of it because they're four different people, the different segments or the different, you know, lines of dialogue. So it's kind
sure,
of a kooky
that's
example,
a great point. I was just going to say, it reminds me of the line that's at the in the first section of the book where he talks about St. Paul talking about, you know, milk for babes and meat for strong men. It's like you know, you kind of give people what they're ready to hear, in essence. And that's, I think, the mystery schools were set up in order to do just that, to teach people at the level they were at and then take them further than they thought that they might be able to go. Getting back to that, though, the idea of these secret societies and these mystery schools, you know, some people might not be familiar with them that are listening. What we're really referring to were these religious organizations. I'll just quote Manly Hall. He said, these individuals were usually banded together, forming seclusive philosophic and religious schools. The more important of these groups were known as the mysteries. Many of the great minds of antiquity were initiated into these secret fraternities by strange and mysterious rites, some of which were extremely cruel. Alexander Wilder defines the mysteries as sacred dramas performed at stated periods. The most celebrated were those of Isis, Sabazius, Sibyl, Eleusis. Of course, there's the Orphic mysteries, there's Freemasonry, there's the Pythagorean school, and so forth. I mean, there were thousands of these different mystery schools operating in the ancient world, and they were extremely popular with the people. And they were designed to train people in wisdom, essentially. And Manly Hall pointed out in a book that I would highly recommend, we were talking about this earlier, called The Adepts in the Esoteric Classical Tradition. It's a series of books. Part one is The Initiates of Greece and Rome. If you can get a copy of this online, it's a fantastic book. Is it available on that Manly Hall download site? Or did you?
No,
you...
it's not on that. No. It's actually available through the PRS, and I think they sell it on Amazon. So it's commercially available from the source.
Okay. Oh, very good. All right. So it's called The Adepts in Esoteric Classical Tradition by Manly Hall, Part 1, Initiates of Greece and Rome. But Manly Hall points out really the purpose of these groups and kind of what they were designed to do, the sort of functionality of them. And what he calls that is the of the mysteries. In other words, what is kind of the mission of these things? And essentially, he defines these three levels of purposes. Number one, the redemption of all sentient beings. That was one of the purposes. The second was the restoration of the universal religion. And third was the reformation of human society in general. When he speaks about the universal religion, we're really talking about that ancient wisdom that's often called the golden thread or the golden chain, or you hear about archetypal universal ideas. And really, in the esoteric world, what you're talking about is a wisdom that goes back to ancient times, pre-flood, antediluvian times is really what they're talking about. And if it's, you know, if you're speaking in the world of theosophy or the Blavatsky type thinking. That would be the Atlantean and Lemurian and other epochs that existed prior to ours, where this ancient wisdom was brought forward in hidden ways, and that was another one of the main functions of these mystery schools and these secret societies, was to keep that flame of wisdom alive in every generation. Do you have anything to add to that?
Well, that is the reason, you know, keeping the sacred secret, to protect it. And
yeah,
it's again, the benefit for the public or for the uninitiated still can come through, because, you know, this reason for having these mystery schools, a reason for keeping this sacred knowledge and also perpetuating it. They were keeping it alive generation to generation to generation, because it's important and it does get put into use by the people who have it and have it to use, that would somehow disseminate and get, you know, distilled out into the public realm, if it were senators in Rome that, you know, had the training. They were in a position to pass laws. And the idea was that, you know, people that had a little more power to influence, that had to be tempered with wisdom. Otherwise, it just is, if it's unbridled, you'll just turn into a, you know, like a Caesar or something that's, you know, mad with sure. power. But it also informs the decisions, because they are, they're not just, it's not just knowledge. It's the great ethics of society, the yeah. ideals of humanity, that are contained in these mysteries as well. And as long as they're not misused, and as long as they are used properly, they can benefit generation after generation in any time.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think one of the things that that Manly Hall quotes from is Robert McCoy's book. He was a 33rd degree Mason. He has a book called General History of Freemasonry, which is an excellent resource. And he talks about these secret societies and mystery schools. And he wrote that it appears that all the perfection of civilization and all the advancement made in philosophy, science, and art among the ancients are due to these institutions, which under the veil of mystery sought to illustrate the sublimest truths of religion, morality, and virtue, and impress them on the hearts of their disciples. Their chief object was to teach the doctrine of one God, the resurrection of man to eternal life, the dignity of the human soul, and to lead the people to see the shadow of deity in the beauty, magnificence, and splendor of the universe. Well, well written, Mr. McCoy. Wow. But that's a really eloquent way of kind of describing what these schools did and still do today. I mean, many of them are still alive in these other institutions. I mean, Freemasonry had quite a bit of the ancient mysteries in it. We'll touch on a couple of those things a little bit down the line. But much of the ritual is based on the Greek mystery traditions and the Roman mystery traditions, Greek and Roman philosophy and symbolism. So, you know, Freemasonry has it. There are many magical groups today that have a fraternal structure that are based on Freemasonry, such as, like I mentioned earlier, the Golden Dawn, the OTO, Paul Foster Case's BOTA, which still exists in Los Angeles. So these are some of the modern versions. They're certainly not as rough and challenging as the ancient schools were. No one is being put in a boat and without a sail on it and expected to live through an ordeal or thrown down into a pit with a tiger or some other such trials. But, you know, they have their own structure. Symbolic initiatory rites that they do. And I think these are valuable things that are still, that still exist today and can teach one more about these schools. So moving along, we're going to talk a little bit about the Druids. There is a section on the Druids. We were going to skip this, but I just wanted to cover it really briefly because the Druids are interesting and important, and who doesn't know Stonehenge? from either seeing it in a picture or from Spinal Tap. So what's that line when they bring it down? I can't, do you have any good Stonehenge lines from that movie that you remember off the top of your head? Cause they're escaping me at the moment, but I just remember.
Yeah. I was just that they had the proportions wrong and it was 18 inches instead of 18 feet tall. And it was at risk 18 of being feet.
That's right. You know,
trampled on by dwarves.
Being trampled on stage. Right. That's right. Yeah. That's right. I love that scene when they expect this majestic model of Stonehenge. And instead, it's like the size of a large birthday cake or something. Yeah. So, genius stuff. All right. So, at any rate, the Druids were an ancient race of people who lived in Britain and Gaul. Gaul is ancient France, and they lived, according to the Romans, who took them over and actually ruled the area from about 43 A.D. to 410 A.D. I think. The British were there earlier, but they had trouble beating back the Celts and so forth, which you can see in that's Braveheart, is it not?
I believe so.
Which, yeah. So this is the ancient race of people that lived in that area, but their religious system and their priests were called Druids. The Druids were also set up in sort of a three-level system or hierarchy, which Manly Hall notes is very similar to Blue Lodge Masonry, which we talked about earlier, which is the outer kind of Freemasonry order that most people are familiar with. But the Druids had Ovates, Bards, and Druids as their levels, and that was their kind of initiate, and then the sort of, you know, fellow craft in the middle, and then the Master Mason would be the Druid, the equivalents of those. And they existed quite powerfully, apparently, for hundreds, if not thousands of years before the Romans showed up, and had a very sophisticated religion, had a very sophisticated system of medicine, herbs, science, geography, natural theology, astrology, and astronomy. We do know that most likely Stonehenge was used for some sort of astrological or astronomical correspondence, and also for some sort of religious ritual purpose. I mean, they still don't know exactly what it was used for, but I know there's a lot of theories that it ties to different phases of where stars are and things like that, right? I mean, it has those connections to it, does it not?
They were definitely, the Druids, deeply connected with nature. So yeah. It's easy to see a possible link between Wiccan and, more nature-based traditions
have
an affinity for the Druids, because, and you mentioned, the plants and the medicine, that's part of that being connected with nature, had to do with medicine and these herbs and healing, the pharmacology of nature. They were very, very interested. It wasn't all that abstract, although there's plenty of abstract thought with principles, sure. Things like that, but there's, definitely the very practical and literally down to earth where they were planting things. So things with, harvest ceremonies, planting rituals, moons and seasons, equinox, those were, it wasn't just some symbolic thing. They had a very practical connection with the land and growing these healing plants.
That's a great point. And I think a lot of the people that are interested in neo-paganism today, especially in Scotland and Wales and Ireland and England and the UK proper, are interested in a lot of these kind of ancient ideas that are, I think, based on a lot of what the Druids were supposed to done or did. There's not a huge amount of information about them. A lot of it is speculative, unfortunately, because they didn't write down much of anything. So most of their lore, their mythology, their rituals, their knowledge was passed from disciple to teacher to disciple. And so, you would have to memorize those things, much like in Africa or in a lot of other oral cultures around the world, they had a pretty they had an oral culture. So until the Romans came, there wasn't a system of writing, I don't think, to write that work down. Am I right about that, or am I stretching a little bit? Maybe they had to.
Well,
they did have a system of writing, and they just didn't write things down. Is there alphabets prior to Latin?
Well, as far as, I mean, you know, runes and symbolic language markings, you know, symbols.
Good point.
Would have been strong, but as far as a more alphabetized, and then like a book of rules or beliefs, I don't think there isn't much. Whereas, in ancient Greeks, there's stone fragments.
Yeah,
of incomplete works, but there is existing, set in stone. Maybe they were written on something that was less durable if they were written down. But I think maybe there's something about if you do write something down, then somebody can take it or steal it, or it can fall into the hands of somebody who wouldn't know, first of all, what to do with it, but certainly wouldn't know how to work it and could endanger themselves and others.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good point. And that was something that ran through all of these secret societies and mystery schools, was that idea of the knowledge being powerful and sort of keeping it from the profane. You know, it's like not throwing your pearls before swine, like Jesus said. I mean, I think that there's a power to the respect of the knowledge that I think today we don't really grasp, because information is so cheaply, easily, and 24/7 available. For most of the time for free, actually, not even cheaply, but free, yeah. Freely. So, so
that doesn't, that's not where it's hidden now. Now the secret is in what this stuff is and how to use it. What does it mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Ancient times, people understood symbolism a lot more because it was very near to them. Because of written language and, this is history and these are the facts and everything, we lose the symbol. We want to know what's the answer. Well, I want to know the wisdom.
Yeah.
The times I worked at PRS years ago, people say, okay, yeah, this is the library. Where's the secret stuff? Where's the secret class? When's that being held?
Sure.
And
exactly.
It's not that, everyone wants to know the secret knowledge. Just like when somebody gets into martial arts, the first thing they want to learn is a flying roundhouse kick. And that's probably something you want to work up to. It looks cool. But it's not day one kind of stuff. And it's not that you're keeping, the profane from the sacred, that it's some judgment call. It's, you wouldn't let somebody untrained in the cockpit of an airliner. It's for somebody that has training, because it's an important job and there are risks involved, and it takes that. It's not that you're not welcome. It's just that you're just not trained. You don't have the skills, and they don't want somebody going into the cockpit who doesn't have the necessary credentials or skills.
Point. Yeah, exactly.
It's a profession in a way, if you look at it like that. It is a professional degree or skill that requires training. You look at even just like a fighter pilot, an average run-of-the-mill Air Force fighter pilot, for every one of those, there are dozens that didn't make it that far. They flunked out of flight training for whatever reason, or they got airsick, and, can't have that for a fighter pilot. So there are many reasons to fail along the way, and the ones are able to check off the boxes and,
I think that's, yeah, exactly. And I think that was one of the important ways of sort of vetting candidates. And a lot of that stuff today people see as sort of elitism, or they see it as some kind of, block to keep them out because of this or that reasoning in their minds. It's because I'm this or because I'm that they're keeping me out. But I mean, I think oftentimes the reason for these, sort of challenging, initiatory, and oath sort of driven groups was that they were really testing people to see if you kind of had what it takes, almost like becoming like a ranger or a Green Beret or something. It's like, not everyone is going to be able to cut it, in terms of you know, the higher levels of spirituality, it does put a, it is a test. It does get very challenging when you start digging into yourself and digging into the mysteries of the universe to a great degree. And not everyone's up for it. I mean, if someone's kind of marginally mentally ill, it could kind of push them over the edge. If someone has a lot of issues or complex with, it can push buttons and so on. So, you know, you do have to be a pretty self-aware person to be able to delve into a lot of this stuff. And I think really that's what they were trying to do, is keep people safe and, you know, keep the information sort of sacred and holy, in the sense that the people that got a hold of it knew how to use it properly and were prepared for it. I mean, like, in a sense, like higher mathematics or something, you're not going to go from, you know, basic arithmetic and then jump into some kind of differential calculus or something, or, you know, abstract discrete mathematics or whatever. I mean, I don't even know the names of these things. I flunked geometry. So that's, you know, so I need to go back to the sacred mysteries and study.
Well, there's also a danger in skipping steps
geometry
along
sure,
the way.
Sure, absolutely.
You know, even if you're absolutely prepared for the first two, if you just want to skip ahead, in addiction 12-step recovery, it's called doing the two-step, where you start at step one, you skip straight to step 12. you don't do all the stuff sure inside. You know, again, it's
and
like...
For those who don't know, what are steps 1 and 12?
Well, one is admitting that you're powerless over this force of alcohol. And the 12th step is to carry the message to others out there still suffering.
Just carry the message. So you haven't done any of the work.
On day one, you're not getting the message. Yeah. You have to, you got the memo to get there. But as you go through your process, then you can, of course, sponsor somebody and then carry the message to those still suffering. But the messenger has to be prepared.
Great analogy.
You know,
great analogy. All right. So jumping ahead, I would like to spend more time on the Druids, but we need to move forward, and we kind of got on a tangent anyway. So let's get into Mithras and the Mithraic connection to the Christian mysteries. I'm going to start by reading a little section here that Manly Hall quotes. The fraternal and democratic spirit of the first communities and their humble origin, the identification of the object of adoration with light and the sun, the legends of the shepherds with their gifts and adoration, the flood and the ark, the representation in art of the fiery chariot, the drawing of water from the rock, the holy water and the communion, the sanctification of Sunday and the 25th of December, the insistence of moral conduct, the emphasis placed on abstinence and self-control, doctrine of heaven and hell, mediation of the logos emanating from the divine, the atoning sacrifice, et cetera, et cetera. It goes on and on. These are all things that the cult of Mithras and the Mithraic mysteries had in common with early Christian mysteries. So you can see there was a lot of sort of spillover between the two, certainly. And you know, I at one time I do believe that there were more people practicing Mithraism that were initiated in the cult of Mithras than there were Christians in its early days. In fact, I think it had a greater chance of becoming a popular religion if it were not for the zeal of the early Christians and their martyrdom and so forth, and then later the adoption of Constantine's Christianity and so forth. It probably would have been the dominant religion of the region. Many of the Romans, especially the soldiers, and a lot of the hierarchy of the upper, maybe were initiated into this mystery. So it was quite prevalent in the Roman world in the days of early Christianity, and that being after Jesus's death into, you know, 100 to 300 AD, up until the time of Constantine. So Manly Hall points out that the Mithraic initiation was also a three degree type initiation, which is interesting, again, linking it to Freemasonry. So in the first degree, a candidate was given a crown, upon the point of a sword and instructed in the mysteries of Mithras' hidden power. And on the second, he was given armor, and that symbolized intelligence and purity. And he was sent into the darkness of subterranean pits to fight the beasts of lust, passion, and degeneracy. And in the third degree, he was given a cape upon which were drawn or woven the signs of the zodiac and other astronomical symbols. So again, all symbolic levels of learning and understanding. This is an interesting point that he makes. Knights who successfully passed the Mithraic initiations were called lions and were marked upon their foreheads with the Egyptian cross. Mithras himself is often pictured with the head of a lion and two pairs of wings. And then he talks about there's a grip of a lion's paw or a lion in the Master Mason's degree that probably originated from that cult of Mithras. And then also there's a ladder in masonry. It's a seven rung ladder that they use that they also probably used in Mithraic initiation as well. So those are both interesting, connections.
The lion symbol relating to the sun as well.
Yeah. Good point.
You know, a sun god. So that comes through. It's interesting how he mentioned in this passage how the cult of Mithras, in some ways, is a simplified version of Zoroastrianism, the Persian fire magician, Zarathustra.
Yeah.
It was very strong in Persia and kind of at the same time historically when Christianity was finding its footing in the Mediterranean. You have this, you know, the Persian Empire invaded Italy, and that there's, one of the good things, I guess, is this cross, connection with different traditions. So it kind of spilled in and helped the rise of this cult from, the Persian roots were actually coming in to it. And again, some of the Druid principles, and we see it again in the cult of the Mithraic cults, is this connection to December 25th and being crucified and rising after 3 days, relating to this winter solstice and the stopping of the sun. The sun and the lion, a lot of very connected things. But it's interesting that maybe some of that influence came in when Christianity was still a little open and, finding its footing. So it worked its way in there.
That's a great point. Yeah, no, definitely. And there's, it's interesting because throughout all of these different traditions, the solar deities are pretty prominent. And even in Freemasonry, there's a story about Hiram, who's killed by some ruffians and buried and resurrected and so forth. That kind of goes along with this same sort of symbolism. It's interesting that it plays such a large part in the symbolic nature of all these things we've been talking about. And we can't really do it justice in the short amount of time that we have here. But
sure.
But that's a very important part. So the thing that I found really great about this set, the way that he was able to kind of tie all these things together with these different ancient and modern groups, particularly Freemasonry. But like I said, many of the modern groups today do still try to emulate the lessons and the wisdom of these ancient Greek, Roman, Egyptian, Persian, et cetera, mystery religions and secret societies. And they do have a certain initiatory plan that usually includes three levels. And there's usually things that need to be learned and memorized, and there's secret information and so on. So one really does want to, try to experience a mystery group today. It is, Freemasonry is one good example. There are others, if you look online and so on. That still exists today. Like I said, BOTA is one, which is in Los Angeles. There is various Golden Dawn and groups and Theosophy in some ways has some group work that they do. not as much as they used to. But, you know, you can look around and find modern mystery groups. Of course, you're not going to find the level of intensity that it had in the ancient world, because we live more complicated lives. And of course, liability does not allow us to do these excruciating, you know, initiatory rituals with people. It would be too dangerous and it would open people up to lawsuits and so on. But hopefully you can get this in a lot of ways, or you can create your own rituals and your own initiatory rites for yourself. A lot of people do that. I mean, there's Native American groups that get together and do that sort of thing. I mean, there's obviously all the Afro-Caribbean stuff, Santeria and Candomblé and so forth that have these initiatory type formats. And I think there's value in these groups, and I think there's things to learn. I mean, watch out for the bad ones and, you know, read up and so on. But there's definitely something to learn, and they certainly echo these ancient wisdoms that we've been speaking about today. So they're definitely worth checking out and getting involved with if you're so inclined.
And we do live in the age of self-initiation. Could use a little more direction and guidance, and it's great that there are organizations to be part of. But one thing we may want to reiterate is what is the value, the importance, the reason for having these dramas or these symbolic plays, these rites, these rituals that play out. They're almost like stage plays where you're recreating an event or some sort of process. One simple one is, you know, you lie in a coffin and they close the lid and turn the lights off and come back in a couple hours, and you haven't freaked out. Well, you've had some little teeny experience with death. It's not real death, but it's involving the body.
It's a symbolic taste.
And you're
exactly.
And this is where mysticism and these mystery schools become very much a process, a thing that you do. It's an act, that it's an action, like athletic ability, you know, musical or any other kind of artistic skill. Those are developed by doing it. Yes, you have masters who teach you, and yes, you can learn on your own and learn online and things, but you really get better by doing it yourself. And you're so to be, otherwise people could just talk about a drama or talk about something, but when they put a blindfold on you and you're spun around, or you know, whatever the you know, these take people out in the woods for 3 days and, you know, actually very much, you know, strong physical survival. But you've had an experience. You feel like, you know, like a roller coaster is an experience. It's a little passive, but wow, it's dynamic because your body went through that. You could talk about it, but it's not the same. So
you make a great point. You make a great point. The visceral aspect to it is something that is often missing, especially in our screen obsessed lives today. You know, that we do need to get out there and mix it up and feel and be immersed in water or sit on a cold rock to feel the earth, or, you know, sit out in the hot sun and feel thirsty, just to remember that we're creatures of this earth.
Well, even baptism
from it. Mm-hmm. Sure. Absolutely.
They become a little watered down, so to speak. Forgive the pun, but I tried. In that, you know, okay, so you close your eyes, you hold your nose, and somebody and dunks you, and then you're back up again. I think a long time ago in some places, they actually kept you under there for a little while until you're a little kind of starting to scream and squirm.
Absolutely.
And then when they pull you, and it's all controlled and it's safe, this isn't really a dangerous thing, but you get, you're almost like, oh my gosh, I can breathe again. It becomes, wow, this is the stuff of life. And, you know, I was kind of close to an edge, or at least I was near it. And, you know, your body feels it because it was deprived of something it needs every minute to live. And your experience with it. Now, if somebody's just watching it, or you're telling somebody, oh, yeah, we're going to dunk in water. Okay, well, so what? That means nothing.
Yeah.
If you understand the symbolism behind it and the meaning, and then you go through the ritual yourself, you're going to have a completely different understanding that can't be described.
No, exactly. That's an excellent way to put it. All right. So unfortunately, that about does it for our time today. We have been talking about part 2 of the secret teachings, which is the section Roman numeral 2, the ancient mysteries and secret societies which have influenced modern Masonic symbolism, and that's part one, section of part of you know, Roman numeral 2 section. Next week we're going to do part 2. And that covers, actually, I'm sorry. Yeah, part 2, but it's going to read Roman numeral section 3. So it's a little bit confusing the way the book is laid out. That's in the reader's edition. It might be, yes, a little different in the big book. I think it actually sticks to the correct numbering. But either way, it is the ancient mysteries and secret societies, the three-part section that we're looking at. So next week we'll be looking at 2, which is Christian and pagan Gnosticism, early days of that, and Greco-Egyptian mystery systems, Serapis, and Odinic mysteries, and other great stuff. So do join us for that. This was our 9th podcast, so we're excited to be here, and we're excited that you're listening and supporting us here at Cosmic Eye. So please do tune in next week for our next episode. And I am your host, Jason Napolitano, author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate. And we have also here Chris Sheridan, and he is the author of The Spirit in the Sky. Both of our books are available online on Amazon or at chrissheridan.com or cosmiceye.com, .org in my case. So please join us again next week, and thank you and God bless.
Thank you for listening, and please join us next Sunday for a new episode of Cosmic Eye. You can purchase If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate at amazon.com or through our website, cosmiceye.org.